There are some, even here, who are facing things that look like they will never change. All hope is gone to ever see the consequences of that sin reversed. Living for days, months, years, and decades with the pain of the past. If you could do it all over again, you would definitely do it differently. You name the category, and there's going to be somebody here who fits it. You would not start it out with those drugs. You would not have started out with that alcohol. You would not have started out with that relationship. You would not have started out with that debt. You would not have started out with whatever it is, because whatever it is won't leave you alone. And not only has it not left you alone, when you look down the portals of the future, you don't see a change. It looks unfixable and irreversible. It does not change. It seems that it cannot change. And you've settled into the fact it won't change. How many of you like puzzles? Anybody like putting together puzzles? Well, today we're going to have a puzzle. And we're going to see the protrusions and the indentations of this puzzle come together to address the issue of irreversible consequences. Can they be reversed? Is there the possibility that things could be different, although they look like they can't be? You're going to have to stick closely with me, because as puzzles go, you've got to connect the dots in order for the full picture to be seen. Gehazi is Elijah's servant. Elijah has just instructed Naaman how to be healed 7 times in the Jordan. Naaman dips down 7 times, comes up totally healed, and then turns and offers Elijah money, clothes, silver, gold, well worth in today's dollars over $1 million. And Naaman says, Elijah, because you gave me the secret to this healing, I'm going to make you a millionaire. In verse 16, Elijah turns him down. I can't take your money. I can't take your clothes. It's not about that. And he turns down the money. Gehazi sees him turn down the money. To which Gehazi says, you got to be out of your mind. You didn't heal this man. You're offering him well over $1 million, and you're going to turn it down. So when Naaman leaves, Gehazi goes after him. When Gehazi catches up with Naaman, he says to him, my master sent me. And he told me to catch up with you because we got 2 seminary students. He calls them sons of the prophets. We got 2 students who need a scholarship to get through school, who need some clothes because they poor seminary students. And so he sent me to get a little something, something from you. Let me have a talent and some of the clothes. So before I get any further, let me tell you what's going on now. The Bible calls it the sin of covetousness. Covetousness is desiring and plotting to take something that is not yours to have. That's covetousness. A synonym for it is greed. Going after something that is not legitimate for you to have in an illegitimate way. Colossians 3:5 calls covetousness idolatry. It is the worship of God, worship of another God, because you don't believe your God is the source, so you go to an illegitimate means to get it. Covetousness. Jesus said in Luke chapter 12, about the covetous man. You don't have to turn there. He said, be aware of every form of greed. It comes in different shapes and different forms. And you know you're a covetous person when you plot to get something you're not authorized to have in an illegitimate way through deception. He says, Elijah sent me. Elijah didn't send him anywhere. Not only that, but there was a fundamental mistake that Gehazi made. He said, Elijah sent me. He uses Elisha's name. He uses God's name. But he leaves out a phrase that Elisha said when he was offered the stuff. Because in chapter 5, verse 16, Elijah said, as the Lord lives, before who I stand. Before who I stand, it means to whom I'm accountable. In other words, Elijah knew he was not just accountable to other folk, he was accountable to God. And God would see what he was doing, even if no man saw it. So Gehazi says, Elijah sent me, and as God lives, but not before whom I stand. He lost sight of a divine accountability. The moment you lose sight of God, then you're free to deceive, trick, connive, because you forget God is watching. Elijah didn't forget, Gehazi did. So he comes and he says, show me the money. I got some seminary students here. Elijah sent me to help. Naaman is glad to oblige. So Naaman goes and hands it to Gehazi, 2 talents, some clothes. Gehazi goes, takes it to his house and hides it. He then goes to Elijah and Elijah says, where you been? Gehazi says, I ain't been nowhere. Elijah says, did not my heart go with you? When you went to Naaman and when you connived to get this, how you know this? I figure anybody who can tell somebody to be healed by dipping in the water 7 times must have a divine hookup. Well, you know this. You know how it is when you want something that you're not supposed to have, but you plot to get it. It reminds me of the overweight businessman who came to work with a sack of donuts. He came to work with a sack of donuts, and everybody said, what are you doing with those donuts? You're supposed to be on a diet. You're supposed to be losing weight. Oh, he said, these are spiritual donuts. These are not regular donuts. These are God-ordained donuts. What you mean, God-ordained donuts? Well, so it was like this. I was on my way to work, and I would pass a donut shop and a sign in the window, special sale on donuts. I said, now, God, if you want me, if it's in your will, for me to have donuts, then I'm going to drive around the block, and if there's a parking space, I'll know that it's your will for me to have these donuts. He said, after the 7th time going around that block, there was a parking space, so I knew God wanted me to have that donut. See, we can create in our minds a rationale of legitimacy for stuff we want to do that we know is outside of what we ought to do. Some of us have got stuff from work in our house because we rationalized they won't miss it, even though the Bible calls it theft. We can create things and craft things to arrange it so that it feels all right, even though we know it's not. Elijah has scoped him out. And this is what Elijah tells him. Therefore, verse 27, the leprosy of Naaman shall cling to you and to your descendants forever. So he went out of his presence, a leper, as white as snow. Let's look at the consequences of his decision. Consequence number one, a personal curse, leprosy. Leprosy was where the skin became white, diseased, all kind of breakouts on it, and it was incurable and unreversible. According to Leviticus chapter 13, verses 45 and 46, when you got leprosy, you now had to move outside the camp because it was contagious. So you could give somebody else leprosy. So you now were personally removed from family and friends when it got to a certain level, and now you couldn't work a regular job. It affected you economically, it affected you socially, it affected you relationally, it affected you obviously physically, because you now cursed. And there was no way to fix it. It was irreversible. Perhaps there's somebody here today who feels like you're living under a curse. This thing won't go away. It's affected every area of your life. That one drink has made you an alcoholic. That one hit has turned into something else where a drug owns you. That one thing is now spreading all over you, and there's no cure. You are a leper. No solution. But not only that, he says, you shall be a leper and your descendants. Your descendants. Your children. There are some folk under the sound of my voice whose children are picking up your sins. Or you've picked up your parents' sins. Your daddy was violent to your mother, so you're violent to your mate. Your daddy and mama cuss like sailors to one another, so you and your mate cuss like sailors to each other. Daddy was an alcoholic, you've become one. And on and on and on and on. Mama lived in debt, we live in debt. It just passes on. And so your children are going to pick it up, and they're going to just pass it on. Grandmama and granddaddy got divorced, so mom and daddy got divorced, so we're going to get divorced, so our kids going to get divorced, and it just goes on and on and on. It says, and your descendants. Not only that, he tells them it'll never change forever. This will never, ever end. It's irreversible. Not only that, it's public. He became white as snow. You could see it. He's on his face. Whatever wasn't covered up, you could see he was in a hot mess. Not a mess, a hot mess. All we can do to say about Gehazi right now is All we can do for Gehazi right now is feel sorry for the boy, because he's in an incurable, irreversible, unfixable, undeniable mess because of his sin. You know what it is to have that thing that plagues your soul? That's the first piece of the puzzle. Let's go to the second piece of the puzzle. Let's fast forward to chapter 8. Let me read it to you. Verse 1. Now Elijah spoke to the woman whose son he had restored to life, saying, arise and go with your household and sojourn wherever you can sojourn, for the Lord has called for a famine, and it will even come on the land for 7 years. So the woman arose and did according to the word of the man of God, and she went with her household and sojourned in the land of the Philistine 7 years. At the end of 7 years, the woman returned from the land of the Philistines, and she went out to appeal to the king for her house and for her field. Now the king was talking with Gehazi, the servant of the man of God, saying, please relate to me all the great things that Elisha has done. As he was relating to the king how he had restored to life the one who was dead, behold, the woman whose son he had restored to life appeared to the king for her house and for her field. And Gehazi said, my lord, O king, this is the woman and this is her son whom Elijah restored to life. When the king asked the woman, she related to him. So the king appointed for her a certain officer, saying, restore all that was hers and all the produce of the field from the day that she left the land, even until now. I got a question. What in the world is Gehazi doing in the palace? What is he doing in the palace? This boy is a leper. Leviticus chapter 13, verse 44 and 45 says lepers have to be segregated from the congregation. But now he's talking to the king. And if you're going to protect anybody, it's going to be the king. Not only is he talking to the king, he is a liaison between Elijah and the king, because he now has a job. He's still called the servant of Elijah. So he's standing between Elijah and the king when he's been condemned to be outside due to leprosy. Well, come on now. I need some more pieces to this puzzle, because chapter 5 and chapter 8 don't make sense. Enter a woman. A woman whose son had been raised from the dead. We're told in those first few verses of chapter 8 that this woman, the Shunammite's son, was raised from the dead by Elisha. In the first three verses of chapter 8, you see the phrase 7 years, 7 years, 7 years, and seven is the number of completion. Over a 7 year period, the woman is first meets Elijah and gets a miracle, the raising of her son. 7 years later, she comes to the king. What happened in the 7 years? Ooh, another piece of the puzzle. There's a famine. There is a 7 year famine. Elijah raises her from the dead, raises her son from the dead in chapter 4, verses 25 to 27. You have to turn there, but he raises her from the dead. Then a famine hits. Okay, let's find out about this famine. How bad was it? Chapter 6. Because now we operate between chapter 5 and chapter 8. In chapter 6, we read these words. By the way, raising her son was chapter 4, verses 29 through verse 37. But now we come to the famine in chapter 6, verses 25 and following. There was a great famine in Samaria, and behold, they besieged it until a donkey's head was sold for 80 shekels. So they're eating donkey's heads. That's how bad the famine was. How bad was the famine? Let's keep reading. And a fourth of a cob of dog's dung for 5 shekels of silver. They were buying the excrements of doves to harvest the seeds out of the excrement that the doves ate, because that's the only food they could get. How bad was the famine? Let me show you verse 28. And the king said to her, what is the matter with you? And she answered, this woman said to me, give me your son that we may eat him today. And we will eat my son tomorrow. This famine was a judgment due to the rejection of God. And it had gotten so bad that now they were eating their offspring. That's how decadent things have become in Israel. So wait a minute. While Gehazi is talking to the king says, tell me some of the great things Elijah did, has done. He says, well, let me tell you one thing. There was back there, there was this lady with the son, and the son died, and Elijah came in and laid on the son, and the son came back to life. That's one of the things he did. While he's talking to the king about the lady comes in. Oh, coincidence, luck, chance. None of those are Christian words. You cannot have a sovereign God who oversees providence and have luck. You cannot have both in the same sense. No such thing as luck. It's called providence. When God arranges his things that you wonder, how did that happen right now? So she shows up while he's talking about her. Okay, wait a minute. I got to put this puzzle together. I got a leper who appears no longer to be a leper. I got a woman. I got a prophet. And I got a famine. How do these pieces hook up? How do these pieces come together? How is he talking to the king like nothing is wrong? How does the woman show up while he's talking about the woman? Why does this 7-year gap show up? Chapter 7. Verse 3. Now there were 4 leprous men at the entrance of the gate. And they said to one another, why do we sit here until we die? In other words, we're in a hopeless situation and we're just sitting here waiting to die. If we say we will enter the city, then the famine is in the city and we will die there. So we go there, there's nothing to eat there, so we're going to die there. But if we sit here, we're going to die here. So we are dead men regardless. Now, therefore, since we're going to die anyway, why don't we go to the camp of the Arameans? If they spare us and we live, if they kill us, we're going to die. So we're going to die anyway. So let's go over there to that army that's against Israel and let's ask them if they'll give us some food. They may kill us, but we're going to die anyway. So we're in a catch-22 that's unfixable. So they arise at twilight. And they go into the camp because the camp has food. This is the enemy of Israel and they're keeping food from Israel. Verse 6. For the Lord had caused the army of the Arameans to hear a sound of chariots and a sound of horses, even the sound of a great army. So they said to one another, behold, the king of Israel has hired against us kings of the Hittites and kings of the Egyptians to come against us. Therefore, they arose and fled in the twilight. Stay with me here. They said, we stuck. We're going to die here. If we go there, there's no food. The only food is with that enemy army. So we might as well take a chance. Because they might kill us, but let's take a chance. When they took a chance, they discovered God had already gotten rid of the problem. If they would have stayed outside and done nothing, they would have never discovered what God had already done. He had already scared the Aramean army so that they fled. And when they fled, well, I said, stay with me now. Stay with me now. When they fled, they left all their stuff behind. Because when they fled, the lepers come, verse 8, they enter the tent. And they ate and drank and carried from there silver and gold and clothes and went and hid them. And they returned and entered another tent and carried from there also and went and hid them. This is called the lottery. These folk hit the lotto. I mean, they are living. They are, woo, how lucky can you get? Don't act like you don't know nothing about the lottery. But wait a minute. Verse 9. Then they said to one another, stay with me here. We are not doing right. This day is a day of good news, but we are keeping silent. If we wait until morning light, punishment will overtake us. Now, therefore, come, let us go tell the king's household. Okay. They up there eating the food and drinking the juice, and they up there getting the silver, getting the gold, getting the clothes. They go hiding them. And one of them said, wait a minute. Been there, done that. Wait a minute. Getting stuff, hiding stuff, misusing stuff. And he says, and if we do this, somebody's going to find out about it. Because been there, done that. So instead of that, they change their minds. Rewind. When Gehazi took that which was not his to take, Elijah says to him, just before he sentences him, is it time for you to have silver, gold, clothes, this, that, and the other? He said, it's not wrong that you wanted it. It's wrong that you wanted it in this time. He said, it's not time. Whenever you have to connive to get something God has not given you, it's not because it's necessarily wrong to have it. It's not your time. When you have to be illegitimate to get it, that means you run into maybe a content problem, but definitely a timing issue. Because when the Bible says God gives something, he gives no sorrow with it. So if you got to be manipulating to make it happen, then what you have done is that you have misused the time. But now, this table has been laid out because God had gone before them and cleared it up. So that now there's all this stuff, but they say, well, no, let's get this for ourselves. Let's take this for ourselves. And then one remembers and says to the other, three, no. Been there, done that. What I'm telling you is that these four lepers are Gehazi and his sons. Go back. You're going to be a leper, and so will your descendants. You got to connect chapter 5 with chapter 8, and somebody's got to explain how he's now in the king's court with no issues and contagious. And how does these four characters, the king, Elijah, the woman, Gehazi, and then this central event, the famine, hook up so that he's now in the king's court? It's comparing scripture with scripture. The reason that the names are not given is because he's living under a curse. What's the point? What is the point? Over and over again in chapter 8, 7 years, 7 years, 7 years, 7 years, 7 years, the time of completion. Oh, let me give you another word for it. It's called retest. A retest is when God creates the exact same situation or a similar situation to it to see whether you learned your lesson. It's called a retest. You know the one thing I loved in school about retest? That means the teacher was giving me another chance. When there was no retest, there was no other chance. But when she said, I will, or he said, I will allow you another retest, that gave me hope that my failure on the previous test didn't have to define what happened to me in that grade. It does not change my previous grade, but it gives me hope for a better tomorrow because it's a retest. Notice it's the exact same situation with the exact same stuff. Silver, gold, money, clothes. He says the problem, Gehazi, is it's not time. Meaning another time, it will be time. But it's not time now. He gives him a retest. If you are in an irreversible situation, you ask God for a retest. Lord, give me another opportunity to take the exam again. And it's going to take you 7 years. Why? Because you got to take it till you complete it. 7 is the number of completion. You can't take a third of the exam. You can't take a half of the exam. You can't take 2/3 of the exam. You must finish the full completion of the exam. It's like you telling your child, clean the room. They clean half the room and wonder why you're not congratulating them for the half they cleaned. Because they did a part of it. They didn't do all of it. And until they do all of it, they don't get recognition for any of it. So what a lot of us do is we do part of the retest, some of the retest, and think God ought to be congratulating us not till you finish the 7 years. That is, not till you complete the exam of all God has asked you to do. It's a retest. It is an opportunity. Now, notice. They could have sat there at the gate and kept feeling sorry for themselves. Gonna die, not gonna get any better. This is the way it is, shouldn't have done it, you know? But they came to the place where they said, I don't wanna go out like this. I don't wanna die like this. I don't wanna die never having tried. God determines whether there's a retest and what the retest is, but I'm sure gonna find out, and I'm gonna take the risk to find out. Those Arameans may kill us, but we're going to take the risk. And when they took the risk, they found out God had already gone before them, waiting for them to move. So if you just going to stay still, stay where you are, and accept things as they are, you will never discover what God may have already set up for you for a retest, a new opportunity. Because you're just accepting things the way they are. My mama was like this. My daddy was like this. I'm like this. My kid's going to be like this. And I hate to hear this phrase. That's how I was raised. That's how I was raised. Well, that may be real. That's how you may raise. You may have been raised in a leprous colony. That may have been how your mama was and your daddy was. What in the world has that got to do with what God can do if you move from where you are? So they got up and moved with their leprosy. And they discovered God had already made a move. They also had to finish the test. I saw on TV some time ago about this 800 some pound guy, just huge. You know, they had to cut the house halfway off to get him out of the house. 800 pounds. And the doctor stood over him and told him, you're going to die. Says, you, I just got to be real with you. If you don't get up out of that bed, you're going to die. He had laid there for years and years, just eating, just getting bigger and bigger. And he says, you are going to die. The man said, I can't even make it to the bathroom. So he's living in filth. I can't even make it to the bathroom. He says, look, mister, if you don't get up, you're going to die. And they so provoked him. That's why the Bible says, assemble yourselves together so you provoke one another. He got all in his ears. He got all in his grill. And he provoked him. And the man got up and he just took him a week to be able to get to the bathroom, to be able to go that far. But he went that far and he kept going and he kept going. And after a number of years, he was down to 250 pounds. Because he decided, I don't want to go out like this. Until you decide you don't want to go out like this. You don't know what God's going to do, but I'm going to find out if he's going to do something. I may be in a forever feeling. I may be in a situation that looks like it'll never get better, but I'm at least going to find out. Because, watch this, if you don't finish the test, it doesn't matter how much you go to church. Serve, give, sing. All that's irrelevant. Because if you got leprosy, only the supernatural can cure you. And so all that stuff is meaningless if you refuse to pass the exam. And God we'll test and retest and retest again, then I'll retest on top of the retest until you get the message, till I get the message, till we get the message. One final piece of the puzzle. While Elijah prophesies at the end of the 7 years that the drought's getting ready to end, the drought's getting ready to be over. He prophesies that it's coming to a conclusion. But the officer of the king says that ain't going to happen. That ain't going to happen. This drought not going to come to the end like you're talking about, preacher. So Elijah tells him in chapter 7, he said, look, not only is it going to come to an end, you're going to see it, but you're not going to benefit from it. Now, look at the end of chapter 7, verse 17. Now, the king appointed the royal officer on whose hands he leaned to have charge of the gate. But the people trampled on him at the gate, and he died just as the man of God had said, who spoke when the king came down to him. Verse 20, and it happened to him, for the people trampled on him at the gate, and he died. This is three times in one chapter we get about this royal officer dying at the gate because he didn't believe what the prophet said. Why we got to hear that three times in one chapter? That the royal officer. Let's talk a little bit about this royal officer. It says the royal officer who the king leaned on. That is, he leaned on him physically, but he also leaned on him for guidance, for information, for direction. He was the royal officer. He was the chief of staff. He was the main guy who the king depended on for information because he's the royal officer. The royal officer said, this thing's not going to end. Elijah says, because that's your attitude, you're going to see it going to end, but you're going to die. And it says when it ended, the people rushed to get the food and trampled the royal officer who was at the gate. Where the lepers at? At the gate. So the lepers are at the gate. They leave the gate. They go find the stuff. They tell the king's household what's going on. The king's royal officer says nothing's going to happen. He gets trampled over. Oh, wait a minute. Wait a minute. When we come to chapter 8, Gehazi is talking to the king. Wait a minute. He's now the liaison. He not only get his job back because he's called the servant of Elijah. He's now the one that the king is leaning on for information. The same thing that the royal officer got to use. Well, wait a minute. When the royal officer got trampled, that opened up a job opportunity. And so now the king is leaning on the former leper to get information. He now has two jobs. He's the servant of Elijah and he's the information center for the king. Because if God's sovereignty allows it, not only can he reverse your leprosy, he can give you opportunities that you never thought could be in your life, in your world, and in your future. What I'm trying to tell you today is that God is a God of retesting. If you allow him, now he's sovereign. He does it when he wants, as he wants, how he wants, to whom he wants. But you at least have to take the risk to find out. He is a God of retesting. And the Bible is full of retest. He retested Moses when Moses was a murderer. But yet he got a retest at the burning bush. And then he got to lead sheep to develop his character for 40 years. Then he got called back in the service to tell Pharaoh, let my people go. Abraham got a retest. Abraham and Sarah concocted up a way of the flesh to give birth to Ishmael. God has said, you operating outside of my will. That's not my plan. Years later, he gave him a retest. That's when Isaac was born and the nation of Israel and the promises of God were realized. Jonah got a retest. He went to Joppa. He then left, went away from the will of God. God sent a whalegram, swallowed him up, brought him back to Joppa, where he could change his mind on the decision he made. He changed his mind. And when he did, God used him to bring a revival. Esther got a retest. She's now before the king. She says, I can't help y'all Jews because it will mess me up. But then he says, listen, girlfriend, if you don't do it, God will raise up somebody else. She went into prayer and said, if I perish, I perish. She passed the retest and saved the people of God. Peter got a retest. He says, I'm never going to leave you. Jesus said, cock-a-doodle-doo. Before the rooster crows, you will deny me three times. He denied the Lord over a charcoal fire. At the end of John, Jesus is cooking over a charcoal fire. And Jesus says, do you still love me more than everybody else? He said, I ain't going that way no more. That's when Jesus said, now I can use you. You didn't pass the test. And he opened up on the day of Pentecost. So God is a God of retest. I believe somebody here wants a retest. I believe somebody here wants a new opportunity. I believe somebody here wants God to do something fresh and new in their life. Stand to your feet and give God the glory that he's a God of a retest and can create a new opportunity for things to turn around.